Irreverent. Entertaining. Cool. You're listening to LA Talk Radio.
You're listening to Answers for the Family with Alan Cardoza, right here on LA Talk Radio.
Welcome to another edition of Answers for the Family. I'm your host, Alan Cardoza, and every Monday from 11 a.m. to noon Pacific time, I will bring you special guests that can inspire, educate, and in some cases entertain, while bringing answers and options to raising children today and in our constantly changing future. Answers for the Family will address issues such as locating a runaway teen, family crisis intervention, building self-esteem, dealing with addictions, and so much more. Now, our topic today is the challenge of representing youth in juvenile delinquency cases and special education rights in today's court system. To discuss this, our guest today, attorney Shep Zeberman, has over 25 years' experience representing clients in both criminal, civil, and juvenile cases, as well as in complex federal and state court litigation. In 2001, he was appointed to serve as a juvenile court referee, where he presided over delinquency, dependency, and informal juvenile traffic courts, as well as served as a judge pro tem and arbitrator for the Los Angeles Superior Court. Currently, his law office represents both adults and juveniles in a variety of cases, including criminal, juvenile, and administrative law. In 2008, Mr. Zeberman was awarded the National Association of Counties National Achievement Award for the best in category of criminal justice and public safety. He is also the recipient of Pasadena Magazine's Top Attorneys Award in 2014. Mr. Zeberman is an adjunct professor and has taught at the International Pacific School of Law as well as other institutions. Mr. Zeberman, welcome to Answers for the Family.
Thank you for having me. It's a pleasure to be here.
Well, this is a subject that comes up, I mean, far too often, within the people that I talk to, because many of the young people that we are working with or that we are transporting to specialized programs, many of them have gotten in trouble. We have spoken with many parents that are very frustrated, over how they can get their children help, but yet at the same time deal with what might be a criminal issue or other problems that have got them into the court system. So one of the first things that I'd like for us to touch on, because I don't know that people realize that there is such a great difference, share with us what some of the differences are between the adult criminal system and the juvenile court system, and why it's important that somebody understands that difference if you're going to have them representing you.
Well, I think the main difference is the focus. The focus of the adult system is on penalty. It's on penalizing criminal behavior. And the juvenile system's goal is rehabilitation of the juvenile. So that's the main focus, I would say. Practically speaking, I guess some of the practical differences between adult criminal court and juvenile delinquency court, as it's called.
Mm-hmm.
Juveniles don't have the right to a jury trial, for example.
Mm-hmm.
They get tried by a judge, one judge rather than a jury. Also, juveniles don't have the right to bail. If they're taken into custody in the first place, they either get released to a parent or guardian, or they stay in custody based upon the level of danger to the community, the likelihood of flight. And sometimes a juvenile is taken into custody and doesn't get released because there's no parent or guardian to release the child to.
Uh-huh.
So those are some of the practical differences.
Now, you mentioned rehabilitation. The first thought that came to mind for me is, wouldn't it be nice if all systems, adult and juvenile, had more of a focus on rehabilitation? But based on where we were at now, so share with our listeners, what are some of the types of rehabilitation programs that the juvenile court can order?
Well, it really just depends upon the needs of the youth that come before the court and what brought them there. People come into the juvenile delinquency court system for a variety of reasons. Ultimately, it's because they're alleged to have committed some sort of a criminal act. But if it's a drug problem, it could be a mental health problem. It could be an undetected learning disability that ultimately causes a youth to act out in school or somewhere else. In some cases, the youth could actually be a victim. So if it's a drug problem, for example, then obviously the court and the lawyers would try to refer the youth to drug treatment. There's a particular drug court. There's also a drug court for juveniles, that is. There's also programs out there that give drug treatment. If it's a mental health problem, then you want to seek appropriate counseling or medication or education. Sometimes the problem stems from poor peer association or a variety of other things. So if that's the case, of course, we seek to get programs that either educate the youth or the parents or both, appropriate social skills or parenting skills on, you know, how to deal with a specific issue.
Now, and it's certainly an area that I'm aware of, because one of the things that we do is we transport directly from court very often, and very often the judge puts it right in the minute order that based on the plan that the attorney, like yourself, has set up for this child, they agree to it. They authorize us to then transport, and we take them off to that program. What sort of follow-up do you need to then follow up with the court to make sure that the court, you know, knows that they're doing well in that particular program, or whose responsibility is that?
There is a follow-up. The ultimate responsibility falls, believe it or not, with the juvenile court, because a juvenile court judge is charged with additional obligations that I guess that's another one of the differences between adult and criminal courts and juvenile courts, is the juvenile court is actually charged with the oversight. So typically, a child that comes to the juvenile court, if you're using the example that you gave as a drug problem, there's quite a bit of follow-up in those cases, because that's a high-maintenance problem that needs to be on top of. Otherwise, you know, chances of success are limited. So typically the court will set very short guidelines. And like you say, there's a minute order, and by this date we want proof of enrollment. So we would provide to the court proof that the child is enrolled in a treatment program. By this date we want proof of attendance. By this date, we want proof of X amount of drug tests, either random or sometimes they're not always random. Just depends. But ultimately, the court has to stay on top of it. And if there is a failure, for example, a failure to enroll in a program, then the court would typically set some sort of hearing to determine why. Is it a willful failure? Is it a problem? The program's full. Could be a lot of reasons why somebody doesn't get into a program. But it's the court's responsibility to follow up on that and then take appropriate action, either to facilitate or sometimes to, I guess, either a carrot or a stick, I guess.
Right. Right.
If it's a problem that can be fixed, then it's the court's responsibility to fix. If it's the family or the child, then that's delaying or not participating, that needs to be dealt with.
It makes perfect sense. Now, you mentioned when you were speaking a little bit about that, you mentioned the times in which sometimes the juvenile is actually a victim. And again, this is another area that we get into, because we also have a nonprofit that works on breaking up human trafficking rings. And so in dealing with minors, you know, that's a huge problem. So can you give some other examples of when a minor is accused of a crime that may actually just be a victim, and the types of things that you can do with the court that still helps them?
Sure. You know, it's very easy to see somebody brought to court who's accused of a crime and treat them as a criminal. But many of our youth are more victims than they are, in fact, criminals. And the most common scenarios that I come across, mostly young girls, sometimes it's boys as well, forced into prostitution against their will.
Mm-hmm.
sometimes we come across scenarios where children are forced into criminal behavior by the parents. And this is often either gang-related or drug-related. And a third category that I see a lot is children who are actually victims of molestation, and they are repeating this cycle. And you know, when these types of cases come to court, it's very easy to say, okay, this is a pedophile, this is a child molester. But in so many of these cases, it's not actually the case, especially with the younger children that are victimized and then repeat the cycle. That once they learn that this is unacceptable behavior, the recidivism rate is very low, actually, for those types of cases.
Yeah. Now you bring up a great point, because so many times, yeah, people will immediately tag that person, this person is a molester, or this person, is a predator of some sort. And the point that you bring up is that if that was their learned behavior, if they were led to believe that this is completely normal, and that this is how a family or gang operates, then it may not necessarily be something to where there was a psychological problem that caused them to do that, but that they just needed to be retrained. Is that correct?
That's correct. And interestingly enough, there's a lot of studies out there that show that the children who commit these types of offenses based upon a learned behavior because they themselves were victims, if it's caught at an early age, like I said, the recidivism rate is very low for these children. They don't often reoffend for those types of sexual crimes. They often reoffend for other types of crimes because they have all sorts of psychological issues that go along with being a victim, mm-hmm. which often results in other types of offenses being committed. And I think there's also studies that show the converse, that the adult pedophile predators that were concerned about, and rightfully so, mm-hmm. Those are not oftentimes people that grow up as pedophiles or child molesters. I saw one study that shows that if you wanted to tag some sort of behavior to point towards what's going to be a future child abuser, a molester, car theft is actually one of the common crimes that they commit. It's not necessarily pedophilia or child molestation. So it's kind of an interesting area of, social studies that kind of...
Wow. Wow. I think you just scared a whole bunch of people that that may have gone for a joyride.
Right.
Wow.
I didn't mean to imply, obviously, that all joyriders or car thieves are going to be pedophiles. I was just saying there is that study out there that the most common offense, I think, that links them, it happens to be.
I understand. And it sort of goes to that same thing of many years ago when they said that, they did a study that said that, and I forget exactly what it was, but, 80% of the heroin users used marijuana. And then somebody within government took that, flipped it, and said, so this means that whoever it is that uses marijuana has an 80% chance of becoming a heroin addict. And it's not the case, but
correct.
But that's what people can take statistics and kind of twist them to whatever it is that that happens to fit their agenda.
And I think I read something like 95% of all heroin users started off with milk.
Yeah, that's right. Yeah,
so
exactly.
You have to be careful with some of these studies because, you have to make sure there's an appropriate correlation.
Absolutely. Now, let's talk a little bit about, you mentioned a little bit just from the standpoint of there being a conflicting dynamic. When you're working on a case that involves a juvenile, what are some of the conflicting dynamics between the juvenile and the parent themselves?
Yeah, that's a difficult scenario for a lawyer oftentimes, because you're representing a child, and the child is actually the client. And parents have a hard time understanding that. Sometimes the parent wants something that the child doesn't, or vice versa. And we're duty-bound as lawyers to represent the best interest of our clients. Now, just because our client wants something doesn't necessarily mean it's his best interest, particularly where you're dealing with children that could be 13, 14, 15 years old and even younger. And, you know, ultimately, just as a practical example, a classic case is a parent may want the child to take the case to trial. The child says, no, I don't want to go to trial. I want to admit the charge. Now, from the parent's standpoint, they're saying, hey, he doesn't really know what he's doing. He's 14 years old. He doesn't understand the consequences, and I don't want him convicted. Mm-hmm. And the child might be thinking, just for an example, I know what's going to happen if I go to trial, and I know after speaking with my lawyer that maybe it's better not to go to trial, and it's actually the child's decision. Now, it would be the child's decision with my advice and guidance, and oftentimes if I can, try to involve the parents in that decision. Mm-hmm. But oftentimes there's a conflict between what a parent wants and what a child wants.
Yeah, and as you were saying that, I had this vision of the parent saying, but wait a minute, my child someday is going to be a senator, and I know they don't want to have this on their record.
Correct. And, you know, ultimately it's the child's decision, and, you know, hopefully we can work out some sort of arrangement if that's what the youth wants to do, where it won't affect his record down the line. And, you know, the other, I guess, area that you see conflicting dynamics is children don't necessarily understand the long run, and they oftentimes want solutions or resolutions that solve a short-term problem. I remember years and years ago, before the three strikes law, mm-hmm. You might be pleading people to a robbery that were in juvenile hall, and in those days they would make a deal where if you just plead guilty, you'll get out of juvenile hall and you'll be on probation and you'll do community service and you'll be done with it. And, you know, the kids took those deals in a heartbeat, not realizing that the law was going to change down the line and be retroactive. Right. These robberies could now be strikes, or at least non-sealable. And when I say a robbery, you know, a robbery can be, give me your bike or I'll punch you in the nose. And that's
right.
I'm not necessarily talking about a guy that breaks the glass of a jewelry store with a machine gun and cleans it out. So but children don't always understand the long-term consequences of what they're doing.
That's a great point. You know, from the standpoint of not knowing what the future will be in store for us. You know, if let's say this is a 17-year-old and it's his second strike, you know, that he did some other thing that was, quote, you know, qualified as a felony, you know, that person is now in a situation to where they're spending the rest of their life knowing that if they were to do anything or got caught up in anything, they could be doing 25 years. So, to life, exactly. That's a great point. You know, and when that change was made, looking at it strictly from an attorney's standpoint, when that change was made in the law, what was your thoughts in regards to that, the three strike law?
Well, I thought it was a dirty pool as it relates. Not so much the three-strike law. I understand the concept of the three-strike law, and there's certain benefits that we've received as a community from the three-strike law. It has taken a lot of the worst off the streets. But as it relates to juveniles, it was retroactive. There's a lot of reasons why, like I said, these kids, some of them pled just to get out of custody.
Mm-hmm.
You know, they weren't given the opportunity of a jury trial. Never would have had that opportunity had they not pled, never knew that there was going to be this consequence in the future, and it, you know, it was retroactive, and I thought it was very harsh, and, you know, saw it go through the appellate process and was found to be constitutional.
So, yeah, and what,
in my view.
Yeah, and well, and one of the issues that I had with it was it was taking one of the decision-making powers away from judges, and that is the person who is probably has the most knowledge of what's going on, you know, as opposed to somebody in the legislature. They don't necessarily know what's going on at that level, and to say, well, we're going to take it out of the judge's hand and we're not going to allow them to look at something and say, you know, well, this person, like you said, you know, this person, one of his strikes came from, you know, from punching a kid and saying, I'm going to take your bike. And we find out later that one of the reasons why he took the bike was because his mother, you know, had called and, you know, and something horrible had happened at home or something like that, you know, that, you know, just allow the judge that's there to be able to look at it and say, look, there's some extenuating circumstances. I don't know that this child should be put in the same category as, like you said, the guy that, you know, that's robbed his third jewelry store or third bank.
Yeah, I would agree with you. It's politicized the process, and it's taking it out of the hands of the judges and those that see and hear what's going on. And, you know, it's very easy when you're running for office to say, you know, we're going to get rid of criminals by doing this. And that, you know, that's obviously very popular and rightfully so. But there's collateral damage that came along with that. And, mm-hmm. you know, these kids have a face and these kids have a, you know, a body and a soul. And you know, when I was sitting as a referee in juvenile court, I used to get people coming you know, to have their petitions sealed. And these, you know, they outgrow it, most of them at some stage, mm-hmm. and they turn their lives around. Most of them do. Not all of them. And, you know, hopefully the system takes care of that appropriately. But most do ultimately outgrow this type of behavior. And to have that type of consequence hanging over you for the rest of your life is pretty severe penalty.
Yeah, I would agree. Well, now, looking at the system itself as a whole, if you had a magic wand and you could make one change in the system, what would it be?
Well, that's a toughie because there's a lot. there's a lot of them. This three strikes as it relates to juveniles, in my view, you know, would certainly be up there on the list. But there's one thing that's always troubled me even more than the three strikes, because at the end of the day, hopefully if you keep out of trouble, you can avoid the severest penalty of the three strikes law. But there's something called a sealing of a juvenile record. And most kids, for most types of offenses, are eligible to have their juvenile court record sealed, which is, I guess, like an expungement. Mm-hmm. Nobody would have access to it, and it's as if it never happened for the most part, with certain exceptions. And that's a good thing because that allows rehabilitation. That allows you to be able to go on and get a job and get a college loan and go to college and move on with your life. And there's a certain provision in the law that came about after Prop 21 that certain offenses that are listed in Section 707B of the Welfare and Institutions Code under certain scenarios can never be sealed. So robbery is a common one. That means if somebody did that, give me your bike or I'll punch you,
mm-hmm.
and it becomes a 707B offense that they're convicted of, they can never get their record sealed. And that becomes a life sentence.
Mm-hmm.
And not the kids should go running around saying, give me your bike or I'll punch you in the nose. You know, I'm not trying to, believe me, make excuses for that. I'm just saying, like you said, the legislature took it away from the judges. And I would have liked to have seen some procedure in there that gives a judge discretion with certain guidelines. The legislature could put in guidelines if they wanted. After 5 years, after you turn 18 or after you're off probation, no criminal conduct, you're making progress in the community, you're either in college or you're working, or you have demonstrate to the court that you've reformed yourself in all the ways that we would have wanted to see our youth
exactly.
reform themselves. And once you've done that, give the judge the discretion. He doesn't have to if he thinks it's inappropriate,
mm-hmm.
But at least give them the discretion. And that, you know, that's not out there, so... You know, I've had many people when I was doing this as a referee come to me in their late ages, in their 30s, and older, leading very productive lives. Now all of a sudden they want to go on and get a nursing license or law enforcement, and they come to get their record sealed and are not eligible. And they would have been had they applied before Prop 21. They just never needed or thought or knew to do it. And now they have this, you know, what I call a life sentence over them.
Yeah, and which if it keeps them from being employed, well, now you're taking somebody and putting them in a situation, if they're now not able to be employed, are we putting them in a situation to where they have to make that decision of, do I go back to doing something criminal to feed my family? I mean, you know, anything that we can do that makes, you know, people get a job that fulfills them and helps them take care of their family, we should be doing everything we can to try to make that happen.
I would agree with that.
All right. You know what? We're going to take a break. For everybody out there, we are talking with attorney Shep Zeberman, and the subject matter is juvenile delinquency cases and special education rights in our courts today. Now, if you would like to follow along with us, now, if you're sitting at your computer, you can go to his website, which is www.zebermanlaw.com. And that's Z as in zebra, E, B as in boy, E-R-M-A-N-L-A-W. We're going to take a break. We'll be back in 1 minute. Feel free to open up another window on your screen. Obviously, if you're driving, don't try this. We'll be right back. Founded over 25 years ago, to meet the needs of families in crisis, West Shields specializes in resolving adolescent issues that negatively impact the family. From preteen to young adult, we are experienced and qualified to help. We offer solutions which include referrals to a network of top professionals internationally that we work very closely with in the fields of educational consulting, psychology, and psychiatry. Our in-home crisis intervention care program helps to stabilize families and bring effective resolution. We are supported by our licensed investigation company that enables us to offer legal and expert services for locating runaway teens and more. Our therapeutic transportation services help to ensure that adolescents in crisis are safely provided transportation to specialized schools and programs with unmatched experience and success. Simply put, West Shield Adolescent Services is the best solution when your family is facing personal crisis. Call 1-800-899-8585 and let us help you. And we're back. Again, we are talking with attorney Shep Zeberman. You're listening to Answers for the Family. Now, Shep, we've got a question that came in. This one came via email. And this one reads, I have read that juvenile arrests in California have dropped and that this decrease translates to a decrease in public safety. So the person sending the message says, can you explain this and is this an accurate statement?
Well, it's hard to know if it's accurate or not. I believe it to be accurate because we don't always get accurate figures from those that are reporting. Just as an example, I know there was a period of time where law enforcement was reporting that murders were down and there was only X amount of murders in the county, and I had more murder cases in my courtroom than they were reporting. So
wow.
I'm a little suspicious of statistics, and it's how you count and what you count. Having said that, the way I think I do believe it's probably accurate. I believe arrests are probably down, and I believe that's because there's and that does result in a decrease in public safety. And I think what's happening is a combination of things. One thing is, I think it's not that there's less crime, it's that there's less arrests. And there's less arrest because sometimes officers don't want to work overtime if they're not going to get paid, and an arrest would result in overtime. Sometimes there's pressure for policy reasons not to arrest, political policy reasons not to arrest. Sometimes, frankly, I think a lot of officers are fed up with the perception that they arrest juveniles and, you know, it's like a revolving door and nothing happens and they just send them home, so to speak, with a slap on the wrist from their perception. So I think a lot of officers don't want to make those arrests, especially for the types of cases where they perceive that not much is likely to happen to the juvenile. They just don't. A lot of them just don't see it worth their time. I've heard officers say it, and I've heard other people claim that as well. So I don't have any statistical or empirical evidence to support it. It's just anecdotal, really. But that's how I would attribute it, is that there is just less arrests, not less crime.
Okay, that makes sense. One of the questions, and actually I had somebody ask me this fairly recently, and they just asked, what's the difference between delinquency court and dependency court?
So delinquency court is basically cases that involve criminal allegations committed by minors who are under the age of 18 at the time that they've committed the offense. So look at that as like a criminal court for juveniles. The dependency court is the court where, in scenarios where the child is the victim of typically abuse or neglect by a parent or a caretaker, then social services steps in and might remove the child from that parent or caretaker, or file a petition in the dependency court to remove the child. And that's the court that determines whether or not the child should remain with the parent, reunified with the parent, or whether some sort of longer-term plan, such as adoption or a guardianship or some sort of temporary or long-term foster care is appropriate. That's the court that deals with the children as victims.
And what about situations to where, the parents, the parents are now arrested. So say the parents have a drug problem, they're arrested. Now that would become another situation in which child dependency court would step in, not because, again, the child did anything or was even, even victimized, but that there now is a parent who could end up going to jail or treatment.
Or even if a parent is taken to jail for the night, if there's nowhere to place the child, if they don't have a family member or a spouse or somebody else, a caretaker, that's a scenario where the child, through no fault of his own, is going to find himself being placed in some sort of emergency foster care until, if the parent is released immediately, for example, then maybe the problem is solved, or maybe they don't want to send the child home to the parent until they sift through how dangerous is the drug problem. So you have, by the way, scenarios where a parent unfortunately passes away and the child is left parentless. So yeah, that would come through that court in a case like that to determine, what's going to be the plan for this child.
Now, in those situations, how much effort is made to try to place that child with family members?
Well, the order of priority is, number one, back to the parents, and if that's not safe or possible, then the second order of priority would be to a family member. And when you say how much effort is made, some caseworkers are better than others.
Mm-hmm.
Sometimes it's, the boots on the ground scenario just does not allow for it. You couldn't get in touch with this person. You couldn't check out the person to make sure it's safe or secure. The person didn't return a call in time, and you keep missing each other. So, there are, a variety of factors that might stop it. Sometimes they're successful in doing it. Sometimes they want a judge to decide, before I send the child to this caretaker, this family member, I want the judge to say it's safe to do so and appropriate to do so.
All right. Let's talk about education law. I know that is an area that not only are you involved with, but it's an area that I see quite often as well. So for those listeners that don't know, share a little bit about the educational law. And actually, I might add that I continually run into parents that really don't have any idea what their rights are in regards to their child getting an education. So I think this will be something that may be a real eye-opener for some parents out there.
it's probably one of the best kept secrets of resources that are out there, and the reason I believe it's kept a secret is because it costs the school district a lot of money to provide a proper education. So, according to the Federal Individuals with Disabilities Act of 2004, which is commonly known as IDEA, students with disabilities are supposed to be prepared for further education, employment, and for independent living. And you have children, special needs children, that may greatly benefit from assistance when pursuing these special education rights and programs that are out there and available. And there's a lot of different forms, 504 plans, you hear the word, but the most common, in my view, is or the most valuable is the what's known as the IEP, the Individual Education Plan. And basically it's done, the process is a parent or somebody would request that the child be assessed for an IEP. There would hopefully be an assessment. School districts often either deny or discourage parents from getting the assessment because, like I said, it costs them a lot of money, and they want to try different avenues before they do that. But ultimately, if a child is entitled to, then he would get an IEP, an Individual Education Plan, which would address the needs of that child so that he can learn on the same playing field as every other kid in that class. Sometimes it's something as simple as moving the child to the front of the class so he can see and hear better or away from a distraction. Sometimes it's something much more complicated, speech therapy, occupational therapy, tutoring one-on-one. And by the way, this is not necessarily children that are mentally ill or mentally retarded. This is a much more common problem. You know, when I was growing up, they used to call a kid if he wasn't doing well in school, they used to call him stupid. Now it turns out, we know, kids learn in different ways.
Yep.
And if you're not one of those kids that's learning in the way that's being taught in that particular classroom at that particular time, you might not be getting what you're supposed to be getting out of that class. And it's often fixable. And that's done, in my view, best done through the IEP process.
Well, we have another listener question that touches on this subject. This comes from a parent that says, my 14-year-old is failing in school, skips a lot of days, and sometimes doesn't come home at night. We went through an IEP last year, and all they did was put him in a class with the, quote, slow kids. I want him to get an education, and I think the only way will be for him to go to a non-public residential school. I know other parents whose son went to one of those schools and came back doing great. What are my options to get the school to authorize this?
Well, getting the child into a non-public residential school might be a solution, or it might just be that the IEP is inappropriate and needs to be tinkered with and or enforced. As I said, these IEPs cost the school district a lot of money. So a lot of times they're inadequate, and they don't provide for or require the services that are necessary. And if they don't, if a child needs X amount of tutoring one-on-one or needs X amount of speech therapy and he's not getting it, you've really done nothing. So the first question in my view is the IEP adequate? And if it's adequate, in other words, does it address the needs of the child? And if it does address the needs of the child, is the district, is the school actually giving the services it's supposed to according to the IEP? So if all of that is found to be true, then perhaps the non-public resource school is an appropriate answer. Now, from the scenario that you described, and it's a little hard to diagnose, you know, on one foot, as we say, but from that scenario, there's a few things going on here. It's always a question, if the child is not coming home and skipping classes, it's always a question of which came first, the chicken or the egg. Is a child not doing well in school because he's skipping classes and not coming home? Or more often than not, I find The child is skipping school because he's not getting anything out of school, and he doesn't want to feel stupid, and he doesn't want to be ostracized by his friends. There's maybe social pressures going on as well, the other dynamics. It's hard to say at this stage. But there's a process called due process where you can force the district to do an analysis and make sure that the IEP is providing adequate services and that the school is providing the appropriate services that it's required to by the IEP. And at the end of the day, if that's not working, you can actually, through this due process, require them to do other avenues such as non-public schools, etc.
Well, I asked you earlier, what changes would you make in our court system if you had a magic wand and you could do it? Let's ask the same question, only with the education law. What would be the changes that you would make, or at least the biggest change you would make, if you could go in and you had the power to do it?
Well, again, there's a lot of changes that I would love to see happen, because I think really every kid should get an individual education plan. I've heard numbers of somewhere as much as 40% and even more of kids in school really should have one. I think it's probably, practically speaking, 100%, because that's not everybody learns the same way, and it's no reflection on somebody's intellect or anything else other than this person learns auditory, this person learns visual, this person needs examples, this person needs these types of accommodations. And in my view, in order to get an education, it has to be teaching the student according to his way.
Yeah.
And rather than trying to fit everybody into what the district is providing.
Yeah, and I think that makes great sense. And as you were saying that, I thought about a quote from John Maxwell. And John Maxwell said that when he was in school, he did really well at English, and he did really well at science or whatever, but he was horrible at math. So what the school did was they said, we're now going to give you 70% of your time in school to focus on just math. And he said it was the worst decision that they made, because at that point, because he had to focus on that, it added so much to his frustration level that he started doing poorly in everything. And it wasn't until a particular teacher said, we're going to do this differently. We're going to have you focus on all of the things that you do well, and we'll get you a tutor to try to help you with the other thing. And now, speaking as an adult, he said that finally what the teacher had said was, here's what you're going to do. We're going to focus on the things that you do well, because you are so good at it that I know that you're going to make a lot of money. And when the time comes, you can hire somebody to count your money.
Sounds about right.
Yes. So, but yeah, I completely agree that, we all learn differently. We all have different ways in which we take in information. And I know that in other countries, that there are, their school systems in many cases focus more on looking at somebody at a certain level of their education and saying, your strengths are here. And then they steer them in the direction of their strength. And we seem to have this tendency to try to focus on our weaknesses. And I'm glad that that's the first thing you'd be trying to fix, because I think I would too.
Yes, I mean, I would agree with you. I mean, the first scenario that you gave, in my view, is kind of like when a child is crying, you smack him and say, stop crying. And, you're not going to get the result that you want by doing that.
But, yes.
If a kid is more artistically inclined or more science inclined, to me, you want to build on that.
Yeah, when you said that, I smiled, because I can remember hearing the words, stop crying or I'll give you something to cry about. I'm glad that was something that seems to have not carried on for future generations. So we have another listener question that came in. And again, I thank everybody that takes the time to do this. I know that this is in the middle of a work day for many people. So we do everything we can to try to get to all of your questions. This one touches on a subject a little different. This one says, please tell me how it is possible that thousands of children have been sentenced as adults and sent to adult prisons. Several thousand, and parentheses, as few and as young as 13 have been sentenced to life in prison, typically without consideration of their age or circumstances of the offense, of the particular offense. How do you see this in the future, and do you see it as getting tougher, or is there a movement to stop this travesty?
I suppose there's always movements out there to stop it. Basically, there is a statutory scheme within the Welfare and Institutions Code. When the district attorney or the prosecuting agency is determining, you know, how to try somebody and what to charge them with, depending upon the age of the child and the offense that's alleged, in some cases they can just file directly in adult court. And mm-hmm. that child will be treated as an adult. In some cases, they can elect, even though they have the right to try the child as an adult, or try to try him as an adult, they can say, well, we think this is more appropriate to be in juvenile court. And then there's a hybrid, what's called a fitness hearing, where they can file in juvenile court, but they file a motion for the judge to determine whether or not the child is fit to be tried in the juvenile court system. So there's basically a five-pronged test and analysis that the judge would have to consider. And after making that analysis, the judge would determine he's going to be tried in the juvenile court, he's going to be tried in the adult court. Now, there are cases where, I guess in my view, it's probably appropriate putting the law aside because some of it's not discretionary for the judge.
Mm-hmm.
But there are cases I could see if a child is 17 and 11 months or he's 19 and a half, but he committed a crime when he was 17 that they just learned about, maybe there's not too much the juvenile court system can do
right
for that person. So a person like that is, you know, likely to end up in adult court by default. Or you have to decide if you want to just drop it. And then there are cases where you have much younger kids, and you're seeing it more and more because kids are committing more serious offenses today, and especially when you're talking about gang-related and the gangs are using younger kids to commit the crimes, the more serious crimes, because the punishments are typically weaker.
Right.
The trend has been to lower the age rather than raise the age or do away with it. Again, I like the idea of giving the judge discretion whether it should be in the juvenile court or not, rather than taking it out from underneath him.
Well, and let me add one point that I think is glaring to me, and that is if your child is in this situation and you want to make sure that they are not tried in but you want to do everything you can for them not to be tried in an adult court, get yourself a good attorney. You know, have some say in this. So anyway, Shep, thank you so much for coming on. And I mentioned the website earlier, but what is the best way to get in touch with you? If somebody's listening to this and they go, I need to talk to him, what is the best way? Is it to go to the website, or is there an additional number?
They can go to my website or call me. The website, as you said, is zebramanlaw.com. That's Z like zebra, E, double B like Baker, E-R-M-A-N, law, L-A-W.com. Or they can also call me, 855-770-1836.
That's great. And for those of you out there, if you're driving, you can always go to our website, go to the Answers for the Family website. Not only will there be a copy of this entire interview, but we will also have Mr. Zebraman's information on there for you to be able to pull it up. So again, Thank you so much for coming on. I think that you've shared a lot of great information out there. I mean, again, most people don't want to have to interact with you, but it is great to know that there are people out there that are going to, that are really going to fight for you.
Well, thank you so much for having me. It's been a pleasure.
All right, great. And for everybody out there, please remember that to tune in next week. Our guest will be Julie Barton, the author of Dog Medicine, which describes her suicidal breakdown where psychiatrists, therapists, and family members tried to intervene, but nothing reached her until the day she decided to do one hopeful thing. She adopted a golden retriever puppy that she named Bunker. And her story changes drastically, but you need to listen to find out more. And again, if you want to share this this with any of your friends, please visit our archives or send them to our archives of past interviews. You can go to answersforthefamily.com or you can check us out on iTunes. And the next time you're on Facebook or Twitter, please remember to stop by and like our page. For everybody out there, have a great week, be good humans, and listen to us again next week on Answers for the Family.
You're listening to Answers for the Family with Alan Cardoza, right here on LA Talk Radio.